Shalom, shalom, and Boker Tov. Good morning. Thank you so kindly for welcoming me back here. They say that a rabbi's job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted. Now, apparently, y'all have taken that fairly seriously because you've asked me to deal with tough texts. And I'm going to try now. I know that I'm following in some pretty formidable footsteps. Is Claire here today? Claire, there's Claire. Claire, thank you very much. You've kind of very much set the context and the stage, and you've done so in a way that is tremendously helpful. And I listened to your talks, and they were very interesting, insightful, well-researched, well-thought-out, and incredibly eloquent. And I'll also be challenging a little bit. I've been told, my father's home has many rooms, right? There are many ways to be correct. Especially, you know, as we might have said last time that I visited, when it comes to Jews, we say, two Jews, three views. So there's lots of room for opinions around the table. I was specifically asked to address tough texts in the Hebrew scriptures, and I will, a little bit. But I had a chance to talk a bit with Trish as well, and we'll also think about tough texts in the scriptures in general, because it's not as if there are only tough texts in one particular strand of our sacred teachings and the teachings that guide our beliefs. But having said that, let's see. How many of us like, you know, sound bites? You know, these days we pull out our phone and we get the news in about, I'm going to say 5 seconds, you know? Maybe we don't even read a headline. We get a tiny little collection of words and then we might move on to the next article, whatever will catch our interest. Especially at this time of technology, we move quite quickly through things. We don't always have the time or the inclination to dig deeper. But today, we will dig deeper. Now, one of the texts that was proposed that we address today was about a man on the Sabbath having something to do with sticks. Does anyone recall a story like that, a passage like that in the book of Numbers? Do you mind just giving us a very brief?
I think it's one sticks.
There's kind of only one.
The other one on the Sabbath. 240, 30, whatever people gathered around and
started to get. Something like that. Some of the Bibles that we might have little summaries over various segments, and the brief summary over this segment often says something like, well, let's see what it says. So in many Christian Bibles that I've read, and far fewer Hebrew versions, or Hebrew translations, right, into English. But in many of our Christian versions, we'll see little summaries of various paragraphs, right? So here we see a little introduction, a contextualization of the paragraph. Penalty for violating the Sabbath. What you are now going to read is a penalty for violating the Sabbath. This may remind us of times that the Hebrew scriptures are very punitive, and that the law of the Sabbath is seen as the crucial issue, and that sometimes punishments for things that seem not to be crimes or criminal to us are inflicted on people that we think really might not be deserving of it due to their action. Before we even read this passage out of this particular Bible, we are already in a particular track. That might be useful or not. At any rate, Here's our passage. The children of Israel were in the wilderness. They found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moshe and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him under guard because it had not been explained what should be done to him. Is judgment made immediately? No. Is judgment made by the masses? Is judgment made by the leaders? By the leaders?
There was some judgment, but it didn't draw him to believe that they hadn't suspected him, for example.
So there's suspicion, but no verdict has been passed, and indeed he's brought sort of to the authorities of the time, right? They put him under guard because it hadn't been explained what to do. Then the Holy One said to Moses, "The man must surely be put to death, All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So as the Lord commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. Is this a troubling text?
Yes.
I think so. How troubling is it? Really troubling? Or just a little troubling? Let's see. Show me. That's pretty troubling. Yeah. Okay. So this surely fits into our context of troubling texts. And again, I'm so appreciative of Claire. You did my whole foundation. There's a lot in Hebrew scriptures which is deeply troubling. And this might be one of those things. There are ways of dealing with elements that are troubling. For example, using allegories. And I'm following again in Claire's footsteps. I'm looking at tools for approaching the texts. I'm not going to tell you what exactly it means. I'm going to leave that for us to figure out together or for you to think of more on your own. But I will say this. There are difficult texts that we have to look at in the Hebrew scriptures, but perhaps not only the Hebrew scriptures. So what's happening here? In this particular strand, someone's collected firewood. Well, actually, we don't even really know if it's firewood. He's gathering sticks. We don't know how many people stoned him, actually. And we might be very uncomfortable with what's going on here. However, let's take a moment. Can I invite this side of the room to please look at verses 27 through 31, the top portion? And this side of the room, please take a look at the bottom paragraph where it says tassels on garments. So just take one moment to read for yourself. And see if you can come up with just, 10 words to summarize what you read. What's the main idea from the first two, we could say, paragraphs from the last paragraph? I see someone who looks just about ready to share with us. What would you say from the first portion?
Well, there's accidental versus intentional breaking of rules. If you break the rules intentionally, it doesn't matter who you are. If you do that unintentionally, then it depends whether you're you're a local or not.
Say that again, please.
If you sin unintentionally, then it matters whether you are Israelite or not.
Mm-hmm. And if you do it intentionally?
Then it doesn't.
Okay, so anyone who does an intentional sin, as it were, a misdeed, is held to the same standards. Those who don't know and do something unintentionally wrong are considered responsible in a different way, right? If I know what's wrong and I still do it, there's one standard for me. If I don't know something is wrong but I do the same action, I'm not treated perhaps as harshly. So the main idea here, though, is that essentially there's one rule for all, yes? Where do we find that? You shall have one law for him who sins unintentionally, for him who is native born among the children of Israel, and for the stranger. Same rules for everybody. Does that seem like a good idea? Apply the laws equally to all people?
It'd be very hard if you didn't know what the rules were.
Right, but this is saying the person who makes the unintentional mistake is not punished in it seems advantageous for the stranger here, doesn't it? It's not that the stranger is assumed guilty, right? The stranger is treated with the same laws as everyone else. There's supposed to be one guideline, essentially, for all, with a bit more consideration for the one who is not native, because they might not be as grounded in the rules.
Is that to say there's the law is the same, but the consequences are applied differently depending on your content?
That is a better way of describing that. Yes, thank you very much. The law is the same. It might be applied differently, and the way that it's applied seems to be a generous way.
Yeah.
What does the last segment tell us from verse 37 to the end? Please.
It appears to suggest something extraordinarily detailed and specific, so that a very broad concept could be remembered.
And what is the broad concept here?
That you
There might be several of them, but
you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy for your God.
Remember and follow the commandments. So the first paragraph seems to be telling us, hey, if we're in a situation where the same laws are going to stand for everybody, the applications of the law, we will try to be generous in them. This passage is concluding by saying, here's a little extra tool, here's a little extra way to remember what you're supposed to do. It might seem strange to us that you put a little fringe on the corner of your garment, but how many of us have ever worn a religious symbol like a cross on their neck? Or for me, a Magen David, or how many of us married and put a ring on our finger, right? These are all symbols. These are all reminders to us, right? So does it make any difference if this passage of the man collecting sticks on the Sabbath occurs in the context of these two verses? Does it make any difference?
Yes.
Why and what?
It's an example of a violation. So the other two things they're talking about, this is the law, and that's the practical application.
Here's the law, here's the practical application, and finally, here's the... What was that, Claire?
You said avoid it next.
See, Claire and I have this thing going on. Here's how to avoid it next time. We're gonna work towards a solution, but this is an example, it seems, that's placed. Well, do we think that this story is put here just coincidentally? Is this random? This is in the middle of Numbers. This is in the middle of a lot of teachings about various kinds of actions to be done that are kind of connected to the cult, to sacrifice. And all of a sudden, there's a story of this guy collecting sticks on Shabbat. We haven't been talking about Shabbat. We've been talking about guidelines and, you know, like put on your indicator before you change lanes, slow down when the light is yellow. You know, we need rules in our society to survive, okay? So there have been all kinds of guidelines. This is put here maybe intentionally or maybe just accidentally, but I don't think so.
Isn't the absolute oath to remind people that I am the Lord your God, and I am that to me puts the whole thing in context, but it's there to remind people.
Absolutely. There's a much larger context, and there are thousands of other implications and concepts that we can take from this. I think that's crucial. And at the same time, Claire guided us to think about tools we can use in approaching difficult texts. I think this is one of them. One of the tools can be looking at context. Now, I'm going to hang around for as long as you folks would like to afterwards, but we have a few other things to look at. So do you mind if we move ahead a little bit? Is that okay? Okay. So I also would like to share with you how this is contextualized within the Hebrew Scriptures themselves, plus a little rabbinic midrash. So it turns out that we are never told exactly the identity of this stick gatherer. May his memory be for blessing. You know, he was really the example, assuming that in point of fact this is a totally historical narrative, he's the example of follow the right way. The rules are going to apply to you. If you're a native, if you're a visitor, do what's right. Okay. We don't know his exact name. But at the very end of the book of Numbers, and we are well into it at this point, a little bit later, just at the very end of the book of Numbers, we're going to run into five daughters. Does anyone remember the five daughters? Yeah? So can you give us just a brief word on the five daughters at the end of Numbers?
They didn't have a brother who would inherit the portion allocated to that family. So they asked if the inheritance could be allocated to the five daughters, which was fairly unusual.
It was tremendously unusual, but it parallels this text so very closely because they asked Moshe, if they could inherit the land, being that there were no brothers. And Moses says, what does Moses say? Friends, check this one out at home. What Moses says is, I don't know. So just as Moses here has gone to God and God has given the answer, Moses says, I don't know. Got to check with God. And God says, yes, these daughters should inherit land. Now, it turns out that these daughters are all the daughters of a man named Zelofehad. They're often called Zelofehad's daughters. But at the beginning of their conversation with Moses, what they say is, our father did not die with the sin of Korach. Remember the rebellion of Korach? In the Jewish lectionary, we read that yesterday. It's very timely. So Korach was the one who rose up against Moses and said, we should be the leaders. You shouldn't be the ones who are leading Moses and Aaron. Everybody is equal in God's eyes. We all have holiness within us. You've just gone too far. And in the end, Korach and his followers, well, let's just say that they don't succeed. So the text tells us that they're destroyed because of what they had done. These daughters say, our father Zelofehad was not among the rebels with Korach. He died of his own sin. Now he's gone and we have no brothers. And the story continues. Can we have the inheritance? Yes, you get the inheritance in the end. The rabbinic tradition attributes this girl's father, Zelofehad, to the man gathering sticks. It's not explicit in the text. It's absolutely midrash. But it comes very close within the Hebrew scriptures. And they say, look, here's the most obvious person that we see nearby who has died. And we don't know any more about him. But when it comes to tricky texts, and maybe this is somewhat parallel, maybe not, to the church making allegories to work its way around difficult texts. It's not so much that it's a parable as that it is parallel, as rather that it's the ancient rabbis thinking carefully, who could this be? How does this make sense? How does this person link into anyone else? And part of what the rabbis seem to tell us is, this is not, this isn't a bad family. He didn't have bad offspring. They're connecting him to women who are seen as tremendously righteous and who, in fact, do have a role in changing the law and changing women's rights, because the daughters do inherit land and women end up having many rights. And these five sisters are emblematic of that. Speaking of which, women in the Bible have lots of rights and do tremendous things, as you all know. Who found Jesus had risen? A woman, right? So the first apostle to know was female. Women have a huge place in our biblical tradition, both in the Hebrew scriptures and the Greek. So one tool that's really worth emphasizing, I believe, is contextualization. Why did our biblical author, provider, redactor, why did God, however, whoever you want to attribute this to, place these narratives in this way? There's a bigger meaning. It's not just one little thing, right? The story of your box, right? If the shoebox, I might have a shoebox in my closet with all kinds of odds and ends, as Claire had said in her talk. The little shoebox doesn't tell you everything about me, but each little item tells you something about me. But we need to weave it all together to have a meaningful understanding. And if our understanding is just based on five words, penalty for violating the Sabbath, well, that's a useful starting point, maybe. But what would it be if I looked at Christian scriptures the same way? Now, Christian scriptures often will have a little introduction at the beginning of each segment. What if at the beginning of my Bible, I use the most often, is Amy G. Levine's The Jewish Annotated New Testament. So the passage that we heard just a moment ago from Luke spoke of the slaves and the masters and the feast. But what if I, in my little book, had a passage that said, okay, this is part where it's going to get uncomfortable. You ready? What if at the top of the little paragraph that was about to follow, it says, God forbid, Jesus endorses hacking up slaves. You like it? Would that be fair? Have you ever read a title like that? You're looking at me like I'm a little, maybe Miss Sugar now, we'd say. What are you talking about hacking up slaves? Are slaves okay in the Christian scriptures? Is that a yes or a no? Are slaves, is slavery acceptable in the Christian scriptures? Okay, it sounds like the consensus overall is in the Christian scriptures where we are led to understand that slavery is accepted. So in the section of Luke where we stopped, which seemed like a really good idea in the context of the service, we read, "You must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour." This was from Luke 13:40. But then the passage continues. Peter said, "Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for everyone?" And the Lord said, "Who then is the faithful and prudent manager whom his master will put in charge of his slaves to give them their allowance and food at the proper time? Blessed is the slave whom the master will find at work when he arrives. Truly, I tell you, he will put that one in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave says to himself, 'My master is delayed in coming,' and if he begins to beat the other slaves, men and women, and eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, at an hour that he doesn't know, and will cut him in pieces." We don't often teach that stuff in the Sunday schools. I hope they don't have knives. "And put him with the unfaithful." The verse is in Luke 13, and there are a variety of translations. This is Luke 13, verse 46. Some say cut him off, that the master will cut off. Basically, it says that he will cut the slave. Is that an allegory? Does that mean cut him metaphorically, cut him off, send him away? Many, many translations say cut asunder, which basically has that sense of chopping up. This was verse 46. "That slave who knew what the master wanted but didn't prepare himself or do what was wanted will receive a severe beating. But the one who didn't know and did what deserved a beating will get a light beating." Overall, this continues, and it's a response to Peter having said to Jesus in verse 41, "Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for everyone?" And the response is another parable in which the master cuts the slave asunder. Now, if I was editing, I would probably look for something else that I could use to as the title of that passage other than "Jesus says, cut your slaves asunder." I don't think that one would flow very well. But it's there. Slavery is there. Violence is there. And Jesus endorsing it is there. I'm sorry, did you say really?
It doesn't read to me like endorsing. It reads to me like it's describing what was normal in society.
I understand exactly what you're saying. And like slavery, cutting the slave asunder seems to be accepted at the time. Again, comfort the afflicted, afflict the comforted. Oh, I wanted to make it so much more difficult first. Do you want to see a little more to like unsettle you? Let me do a little more unsettling first. Okay. I will leave time for questions. I agree 100% with the concept so clearly stated that what will be difficult in our texts will depend on what we bring to the texts as a reader. And here we see some of the key concepts that were shared by Claire earlier on. These might be some of the things that are unsettling for us. Embedded patriarchy, including women depicted as metaphors for evil. Do you know about the Whore of Babylon? What's the Whore of Babylon? In Revelations, around chapter 8? Let's see. Here she is. Chapter 17 of Revelations. "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me and said, 'Come, I'll show you the judgment of the great whore who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine whose fornication the inhabitants of the earth have become drunk.'" So he sees a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. And by verse 5 it says, "And on her forehead was written a name, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of whores and of the earth's abominations." Any Persians here? Any Babylonians amongst our congregation this morning? I teach in Belga High School. We have a really varied community. Some of our students are Muslim from this part of the world, former Babylon. Many also, well, some are Christian as well. I don't know if, I don't know who's included or excluded here as Babylon, the great mother of horrors. But it's discomforting, and it feels also exclusionary. And if we look at number four, which can be quite discomforting, this concern of an absence of universal inclusion is present, and it's one of the tough texts we have to deal with. I have studied Revelations far less than I've studied other elements of the Bible, but if we just ignore it, it might be uncomfortable. It might be intellectually wrong. We might be taking a different direction in our faithfulness if we sidestep what is discomforting in one part of our scriptures and we dive deeply into what is discomforting in another part of our scriptures. The study of Revelations, though, that I have partaken of, has other elements of discomfort for me as a particular reader. I read about the various angels in Revelations 8 who come with various seals and trumpets. So from Revelations 8, verse 7, amongst the seven angels, the first one blows his trumpet, and there's hail and fire mixed with blood that's hurled to the earth, and then a third of the earth is burned up, a third of the trees, and all the green grass. And then the second angel comes, and something like a great mountain burning with fire is thrown into the seas, and the sea becomes blood, and a third of all living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships are destroyed. For those of us familiar with Revelations, this continues on. In Revelations chapter 9, the fifth angel comes, and there's smoke. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given authority like the authority of scorpions. They're told not to damage the grass or trees, which not much would have been left from the last chapter, but only people who don't have the seal of God on their forehead. The locusts are allowed to, from verse 5, torture the people who don't have the seal for 5 months, but not kill them. And the torture was like the torture of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death, but they will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. Again and again with these angels in this portion of Revelations, a third of the earth becomes dark, or a third of the seas become blood, or a third of the peoples are destroyed. The portion of the people who are not destroyed have a particular mark that reflects their selection. There are 144,000 sealed out of every tribe of the people, according to Revelations verse 7. Some get the seal, some don't. If they don't, my sense is they probably are not amongst the one-third that does survive in the population of the earth. For me, this is a tricky text. I don't know if tiny little babies, you know, got to get a mark. I don't know if the mark depended on what language you spoke, or what place you lived, or what faith you followed, or if you were a person who was honorable and kind and good, in contrast to a person who went to the right beautiful church, but perhaps was not so honorable, upright, and good. I didn't find those details. What I know is that it's a troubling text. And in the context of God is love through our relationship with Jesus, I know there has to be something else going on. I need to find that context, because right here is troubling. Okay, I know we need to end on time, but I need to share two more ideas. I'd like to share the concern, for example, well articulated, The scriptures seem to approve of the removal of indigenous peoples from their land. Now, this is a big issue, especially in modernity. And it's been suggested that there was a genocide of the Canaanites by the Israelites, and that that's one of the problematic texts of the Hebrew scriptures. However, the Hebrew scriptures don't actually say that there's a genocide over the Canaanites. There are different texts that say different things. Some say that the indigenous people, that there's war against the indigenous people, as happens usually when different groups are taking on territory. Other elements, though, of the Hebrew scriptures say very clearly that the Hebrew people and the Canaanite people mixed and lived together. And archaeology suggests that quite strongly as well. This is part of the reason that so often we see the Jewish people being described in the Hebrew scriptures as going after idols and following non-gods, because they were mixing so much with the local peoples. So it's a bit of another tricky text, right? It's also interesting that the word genocide didn't exist until the Holocaust, nor did the word anti-Semitism. You can't really say that the Bible is anti-Semitic, because after all of the disciples were Semites, right? Anti-Semitism is actually kind of a racial concept that is very much supported with the rise of Nazism. But there is such a thing as anti-Judaism. Sometimes it gets clothed as critique of the Jews as depicted in the Bible because of an emphasis on empire and domination. I'm not sure that the concept of empire is applicable in biblical times, at least not in Hebrew scripture biblical times. There's also a sense of the Hebrew nation sinning. But I'm not sure that the concept of nation and nationalism exists in biblical Hebrew times. And we're very much challenged, because I know so little. I hardly know anything. There's so little I know. But I know a little bit about this, right? We all have different areas of specialization, and then we rely on those around us and the things that we read and hear to help guide us further. And it's impossible not to have our own lenses of our contemporary society and world when we look at things around us. We can't do anything else. That's how we survive as humans, attempting to make sense of the world. But if we do that without working hard together to understand multiple layers of contexts, as well as which layers of our current contexts are applicable and not applicable, we might not be going in the right direction. What texts are troubling for us, and why? How do we hold difficult texts? Again, Claire, I so agree. Thinking, sharing, praying. Some of the critiques we can see of Hebrew scriptures are presented here on the left-hand column. There's a lot in our Hebrew scriptures which is deeply troubling, and this did come from the lecture, and it was a great lecture. But you might see here I kind of crossed out the word Hebrew. There's a lot in our scriptures which is deeply troubling. The idea of embedded patriarchy, including women depicted as metaphors of evil, we can find in both Christian scriptures and Hebrew scriptures. A warring God with violence, we can find in both sets of scriptures, as we see in Revelations and many other places, for example, Luke. Slavery is acceptable in both sets of scriptures. There are a lot of nuances, there are a lot of guidelines, but it is acceptable in both sets of scriptures, not only one. Emphasis on empire and dominion with an absence of universal inclusion. The first time I started studying the Christian scriptures, I was reading, of course, the book of Matthew. Now I'm a rabbi, and I'm a Jew. The rabbis are descendants of the Pharisees. The Sadducees were connected to the priestly lines. The Pharisees were connected, they were like the proto-rabbinic lines. So for me, when I read about the Pharisees, those are sort of like my professors, my intellectual and spiritual forerunners. They're my ancestors. We actually have the same DNA. They are me. So when I read Matthew 3 and I see that John is baptizing by the River Jordan, and then in verse 7 it says, but when he, John, saw many Pharisees and Sadducees coming for baptism, he said to them, you brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? The wrath to come. Do not presume to say to yourself, we have Abraham as our ancestors, for I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children of Abraham. Even now, the axe is lying at the root of the tree. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. I baptize you with water for repentance, but one who is more powerful than I is coming after me. I'm not worthy to carry his sandals. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fork is in his hand, and he will clear the threshing floor and will gather his wheat into the granary, but the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire. That's me. I know that laughter sometimes is about what's funny, and sometimes it's about what's damn uncomfortable. It's hard for me. It's scary for me to stand in front of you and say these things. I did not sleep well last night. It's particularly scary and difficult at this time, and I know our time is getting close to an end, but I am going to follow Brené Brown's suggestions, and I'm going to be tremendously vulnerable and maybe a teeny tiny bit brave. We could find more examples of Hebrew scriptures having demeaning and abusive descriptions of women, like the women in Judges, the concubine who is cut into bits. But looking at that story also, and you helped us with this too, Claire, looking that, at that in the context of Judges moving in towards the kings is quite significant. Does it justify? Does it make everything okay? No. Does it remind us of needs for change? Yes. Is it tremendously brave to actually read those texts, to actually stand up and be a woman who say, or men who say, I'm hashtag me too. I am hashtag me too. And we need to say these things out loud. And we need to look at these texts. And we need to see what hurts so that maybe someone else will get hurt a little less. So I commend you, and I appreciate your courage and bravery. There are other passages in Hebrew scriptures and Jewish scriptures that are deeply troubling. I'm sorry, Hebrew scriptures and Greek scriptures. Certainly, there seems to be a sense that the world to come, the kingdom, the end of time, apparently in Christian scriptures is to be a time of Christianity only. Yeah? That's the right way? Taking Jesus as Savior is the preferred way? I'm not quite sure. I'm just reading the text. We will talk more later. Slaves accept the authority. Here's where it continues to be difficult. We don't even know what to call this stuff. Christian scriptures, Greek scriptures, Bible, New Testament. But New Testament means that there was an old one, and old usually means outmoded. So just from that term, we are already into that kind of a supersessionist sense. There's the old stuff. Don't really worry about keeping the Sabbath from the Ten Commandments. It's like the old stuff, right? The other Ten Commandments, yes. That one, it's old. Do we call it the Hebrew Bible? Well, we can, but it's Hebrew and Aramaic, so that's somewhat complicated. In Hebrew, we call it Tanakh. That stands for Torah, the first five books. Nevi'im, the prophets. Tanakh is for the Chituvim, the writings like Psalms and Proverbs and the book of Ruth and Daniel and so forth. It is worth noting, though, that the order for Jews of the Hebrew Bible is different than the order of the Old Testament for Christians. The books come in a different order. And as Claire pointed out, in the Christian tradition, the Old Testament, many of the Old Testament passages are laid out in terms of their lengths, yes? And so too in Christian scriptures. In Hebrew scriptures, there's a different layout. There's a different pattern. And so For example, what happens at the end of Judges leads to what happens at the beginning of the next segment of the Bible in a different way. The Hebrew scriptures do not end with Malachi. The Hebrew scriptures end with the book of 2 Chronicles, in which the people who had been exiled are allowed to return back to the Holy Land. And so it ends on a very strong note of hope and rebuilding and an unfinished journey. And that's sort of what contextualizes the Bible from Alpha to Omega in the Hebrew scriptures. And that does make a difference. It changes the story. But I have to also say that the way that Hebrew and Hebrew Bible and Israelite and Israel and nation and people and Israel and Jews get conflagrated. They all get mixed up together often. People often say Israelite from the time before the children of Israel got into the land of Israel. They weren't Israelites yet, right? People often think that Israelis, modern Israelis, are Israelites. People talk about the nation of Israel trying to take over land, and it often leads quickly into a political conversation about modern times and Israel and Hamas. Not Israel and the Palestinians. Lots of Palestinians are Israeli citizens. Helen, and I think you were part of my classes with my Palestinian Christian Orthodox friend who studies with me on a weekly basis. Lots of Palestinians are Christians. Lots of Jews and Palestinians work together just fine. Hamas in contemporary Israel do not get along just fine. But these things get all mixed together, and unfortunately the early church seemed to have a need to put down Judaism in order to raise up Christianity. I'm not saying that's happening now, but it's been embedded for nearly 2,000 years. And it's not something that we can snap our fingers and make go away. However, to everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to pass, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embarrassing, a time to tear, and a time to mend. Each one of us can choose to be part of the tearing or the mending. Let's do it together. Thank you very much.